We are in Ecclesiastes. We are in the second part of chapter 2. And so on your sheets, your handouts we have for February 2nd, we have it labeled chapter 2b and 3. And as Solomon, or the author of Ecclesiastes, is speaking about all things under the sun, what is he referring to? All of creation, right. The sun and the light were created in the first day. And mathematics was invented in Genesis chapter 1. There was mathematics before Adam and Eve were ever made, which makes mathematics that pure language that we all love. But it said in the evening and the morning were the first day, the evening and the morning were the second day, and there God starts counting and sequence. And before there was one, there was none. Infinity. There was God and God alone. We are creatures of time, and that time is regulated by the course of the sun that comes up in the morning and sets at night. And we count on it coming up again the next day. And we are therefore also creatures of the seasons. We're in the midst of the winter if we're here in America, or in the midst of summer if you're with my daughter down in Australia. It's a curious thing about nature. But we are all governed by the seasons. And why does Solomon say all of that is vanity upon vanity? What is vanity? Thy name is woman. No. What is vanity? Emptiness, right. It is subject, as St. Paul says in Romans, Romans 8, subject to futility. Because of sin, it has not accomplished the purposes that God would have set forth for it had there been no sin. And where did death come from? From sin. In the day, and from God's word, the promise, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. And so Solomon has applied his heart unto wisdom, and he's not bragging but giving the fact that he's wiser than any king that has sat upon the throne because God has blessed him. Why does God bless Solomon with wisdom? Well, his asking for it is true, but the first thing is God said, "What would you like me to give you?" It's sort of like that genie in the lamp. What would you ask for if the genie in the lamp said you can have one thing? Five more wishes. Stop it. But Solomon says he asked for wisdom because it's going to take great wisdom to fulfill the vocation that God is giving him as king. It's going to take great wisdom, and he says, "I am but a child." And so he gives him the wisdom to rule. And Solomon, therefore, also, as he has the gift of wisdom, pursues wisdom. And as he's looking at wisdom, last time in the first part of chapter 2, we saw how he compared wisdom, and in his wisdom he wanted to see what folly was like, or entertainment, and the pursuit of wealth and riches and affluence, and to see how that stacked up under wisdom. And when he looked, according to wisdom, at entertainment and the securing of wealth and prosperity, what did he find it was? Vanity. Surprise, surprise. That sort of, I think, gets us about where we are in the book of Ecclesiastes. Any other questions or concerns from our past discussion? Confusions? Well, Confucius is not, this is Solomon, not Confucius. Ecclesiastes 2, beginning at the 16th verse, is where we pick it up on page 4 in our handouts. For there is no remembrance of the wise more than that of the folly forever, seeing that which now is in the days to come shall be forgotten, and how dieth the wise man as the fool. So he's talking here about generational vanity. There are very few wise guys or wise men that are recorded in history that remain in history for all times. And if we find ourselves being a wise member of a family, a father or a mother that gives that wisdom, what is it saying about that wisdom? Are chances good that will be handed on? For how long?
Until someone forgets.
You know, the question that I ask in the margin here is, do you remember great-great-grandpa? How many of you remember great-great-grandpa? Was he wise or was he a fool? He left Germany. Is this wise or foolish? Depends on who you ask. But understand what he's saying by this. And you know, there are some people like wise Solomon who are recorded in Scripture, but very exceptional. There's a wise Luther in the Reformation whose writings, you know, are still at least two-thirds of his writings have not even been translated, but everyone says this was a man who had transcendent wisdom that we should listen to, and we stop listening to him at our peril. Why hasn't all of Luther been translated into English? And why did our forefathers in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, who, by the way, were all German speakers, want to hang on to the German language? Was it because they were stubborn old Germans? Everyone's going, yeah, they were. No, it's because they had more Luther. They brought more Luther over with them from Germany than we have translated to this day. They respected his wisdom so much that they thought they would lose him in translation, and much of him has not even been translated yet. I'm done. Sometimes I do regret that I switched from Walther to Luther, or Luther to Walther, though. Although, again, for our American situation, I think Walther's terribly important. But Walther is not a first-tier theologian, and I would never pretend that he is. He is a good apostle of Luther. He's probably the best English speaker that has transmitted Luther into his culture, and I respect him for that. But don't ever worship Walther or Luther. But the closer you get to Luther, the better you are, better off you are. Read Luther, and don't say I'm Lutheran, you know, not read Luther. And if you want to start somewhere, order the first five volumes of the American edition, the St. Louis edition. It's the American edition, the one that's in English. It's five volumes on Luther's commentary on Genesis, which is mature Luther. It's like 1538 or 1534, 1538, something like that. So it's mature Luther, and man, is he great. He gets all the gospel right out of that first book of the Bible. Just, oh, if you start reading some good Luther, you'll never want to put him down. Just don't start with Bondage of the Will, because you'll go... It's one of his best works, but you better learn some patience with it before you get to it. Yeah.
Can I get the first five volumes there, or if I was necessary?
You can get it on CD. You can get the whole Luther's works on CD. And you're better, and you're well off doing that. I've read him on screen, and it's fine.
Yeah, what is it, about a third
less than the actual books? Oh no, it's about a tenth. It's a huge savings. Trouble is, I ordered it before they published it, so they had a pre-publication price of like $150, and then it came out and it was $125. It's just like everything Lutheran. Everything's backwards when it's Lutheran. All right. So that's that. But again, the generational. We are so short-sighted. You know, one could argue back before the flood that look at the genealogies that are recorded there. they really kept track of their ancestry. It was much more like an Asian culture than our Western culture, where the legends are that they would carve the names of the generations on the staff that they would carry with them, and had a great veneration for the people to come. Is that how Americans are? No, don't trust anyone over 30. Get rid of whatever heritage you have. Everything has to be made new. That's the 60s, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and the sex, drugs, and rock and roll were good at making you forget what came before, to give you the experience of the now. We're the young generation, and we got something to say. Hey, we're the monkey. See, there's even evolution that's in there. But understand that. I mean, do you sometimes ever regret that you don't? I mean, people go back on the internet to try to rediscover their roots and their family tree. Do you ever regret that you don't know who grandma, great grandma, and grandpa, and great great grandma and grandpa are? We're just like the priesthood of Melchizedek, come out of nowhere and leave into nowhere. Verse 17. Then, moving on. Let me read you through the end of the chapter, and then we'll back up and sort of pick it up in more detail. Verse 17, therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. You ever feel that way? What does a Christian mean when he says, I hate life? Does a Christian ever say that? Yeah, and it doesn't, and again, there's a biblical use of the word to hate or despise. It doesn't necessarily mean I hate it like with rage and teeth, but it can mean to despise it in favor of something better. And a Christian, in a way, longs to die. Why? Because there's a better life to come. You ever wake up in the middle of the night and you can't go back to sleep, so you go and you go on the computer and look on your Facebook links or whatever. Last night I got up at about 2 in the morning and didn't feel like I felt thirsty, got something to drink. I went down on the computer and someone had a Facebook link. It was Mark Carnahan. He's a pastor. I think he's now in Nebraska or someplace, but I went to college with him way back when. And Carnahan posted this thing. He says, you can't watch this without weeping. And I said, oh, yeah? And I watched it and I wept. But it was all these scenes of soldiers serving in Afghanistan, coming back and all these surprise meetings at baseball games and that sort of thing. They'd have like the husband dressed up as the catcher and then the kid would be throwing out the initial pitch because dad is serving in Afghanistan, and the kid would throw the pitch and he'd take off the mask, it's dad. So that's sort of heaven, leaving the battlefield and going home to all that have fought the battle before and being home. And a Christian longs for that. That's what St. Paul says, whether to stay here or to go forward, I know not what. I don't know which to choose. He says, it's better for you that I stay, but it would be better for me if I left. Yeah. So it's the same thing with Solomon. He's looking at all the wisdom in this world that has some use in our life. But our life is brief, and it gives way to eternity. And we despise this life, not because we hate the life God has given us here, but there are things that are despicable about it. It's our sin and our falling short and our loving evil things instead of hating them and not being very good in our judgments. There's all kinds of things that are just not very good. But we look forward to the better life that we have in God and his promises. And Solomon is the same way. He's talking about that which is under the sun and that which is the heaven above the sun. And there's something better than this futile life that we live day after day after day. There's the eternal life that is lived in perfection in God's presence and in his house. So, therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit, Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. You don't get to keep anything. Everything that you have is only a stewardship for a while, and you have to leave it to somebody. Unless you spend it all before you go, I guess. There's a bumper sticker like that. Here I am in Florida, spending my grandchildren's inheritance. Yeah.
The sad thing is that you can be a good steward and say, I will either make it better for the guy who comes to be back to me. But I've seen a couple of houses that my family has owned, and they moved down to one of other places. And then when I go back and I look at the mess people made out of it, and it's like, well, you know, you took care of this, you know, whatever, for a while. I mean, mind you, the opposite happens. Sometimes I clean up my mess, you know. But the thing is that whatever you leave, you have no control over what happens.
No, that's right. Yeah, and you can't guarantee how it's going to go after you either, right? I mean, there's nothing really dependable on the earth except God and His Word. I mean, that's why God and His Word are precious, because heaven and earth will pass away and seasons change and people change, but God alone doesn't change. There is that one rock of security that we have in Jesus and our salvation. So verse 19, and who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool, as Gary's reminding us there, yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. So, you know, accumulation of stuff and comfort and that sort of thing is a sign that a person has been worldly wise. They have been able to labor and accumulate more than they need in this life. And that requires human wisdom or thievery. But what happens to it, as Gary reminds us, we don't know what will happen after we're gone, after we pass that on to whoever takes it after we have it. Yeah.
I think the best thing to do is sort of like Paul thinking about the other guy, well, I'll stay as long as I need it, but then I'd rather be somewhere else. It's sort of like if we leave stuff to others, it's like you have to be willing to just kind of like knock the dust off our hands and say, it's yours, do it the best you can, and leave it.
Well. Verse 20, therefore I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. So there's a change of heart here. He said, now I'm noticing this vanity, and so I'm starting to think that way. I'm starting to look at things in that way. I'm starting to turn from a worldly way of looking at things where these things might be profitable. I'm looking at them in another way, as if they might really distract me from the things that are important, and perhaps are now that I've proven they are vain, maybe I should look at them in that way. For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom and in knowledge and in equity, yet to a man that hath not labored therein shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity and a great evil. Why is it a great evil if you leave things to people who are not wise or who are not discerning and who are evil? How will they use it? Yeah, they might even use it for not good things. You know, and again, this is perhaps way off, but I sort of lean on personal experiences. There was a time, I think I got here in 94, and it was about 96 or 97, after visiting a bunch of the shut-ins and seeing a bunch of funerals in the church, I decided that there was a lot of needless hand-wringing when a relative, an older relative, died, because you'd talk to the family, and they didn't know what to do, and so they sort of despaired, and they didn't know what their wishes were. And so I sent out sort of a questionnaire to all of our shut-ins to ask them to make some plans for their funeral so that we didn't have to wonder what hymns maybe we would use or if there was a special reading they had in mind that they wanted for their funeral, and that it would take the pressure off of their sons and grandsons, whoever had to make those decisions. And I think there's some wisdom in that, because when you're mourning the loss of a loved one, it's really a tough time to make decisions. And it's nice when those decisions have been made beforehand. So I thought I was doing a kindness when I issued these. But predominantly all of the women thanked me profusely and worked for about 12 hours each, writing their own autobiography and exactly what they wanted in their funerals. And all the men to a letter despised me and hated me and said, I don't care what's at the funeral. I'm not going to be there anyway. See, that's the way a man thinks. I sort of am of the same disposition. But I also got some feedback from some relatives who learned that I had sent these questionnaires out to these retired old people. And they were angry at me. Why? There was one question I put on there that they were deeply offended over. Have you considered putting the church in your will?
Oh. Ah.
Montgomery Church. Yeah, there
you go. That's all you're interested in. Yeah.
Well, do you think those children that were so upset were church people? They were raised in the church and were outside of the church. And they wanted the money. Now, do you think that the parents who were making the will would be wise to give them the money or to give it all to the church? You ever hear what Bill Gates has in his will for his children? Richest man, arguably the richest man in America. They get nothing. They get nothing. It's going to charity. It's according to his wishes. And there's some wisdom in that. Yes.
I think that's great wisdom, actually. You know, only have to look at Paris Hilton. It's good to teach. I mean, I'm sure Bill Gates has given his children the skills needed to make their own.
Yeah, he's got something going for him, doesn't he? Yes, he was. Divided the kingdom. Yeah. Jeroboam's the other guy. He's the guy in the north. Rehoboam's the son. We were just going over that in 7th and 8th grade Bible history. So they're all right. Thank you. That's absolutely, those are wonderful illustrations of that too. Verse 20, therefore I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is wisdom and knowledge and equity, yet to a man that hath not labored therein shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what hath man of all his labor and of the vexation of his heart wherein he hath labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrow, and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This is also vanity. Isn't this an apt description of life? Every day has its worries for itself, and you lay your head on the pillow, and you still have worries about what's going to happen tomorrow. What do I have to do tomorrow? And what obstacles am I going to run into when I have to try to get my labor done tomorrow? That is sort of the lot in life that we have. Verse 24, there is nothing better for a man that he should eat and drink and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This I also saw that was from the hand of God. Now this is a wonderful verse of contentment. Now, he's saying all is vanity, but he's saying there's nothing better than this. In the midst of all of this vanity is to understand that both the labor and the fruits of our labor are blessings from God. Now there, he's sort of going from looking at what is under the sun to what God above the sun is doing in our lives. Every day we have labor as the jobs that we have or the vocations that we have in our families that present to us challenges and cause us frustrations and anger and grief and labor and toil, but they also are enjoyable. We are sharing our labor with our families. We are able to give our families a reason to be satisfied with the food that they put into their stomachs, and that their nakedness is being clothed by the clothes that we can have on our backs. And we can huddle around in our families, even though the world is at enmity with God, and say, this is still God's creation. God has given us this day and every day, and God has given us this labor and the fruits of the labor that he blesses and allows us to enjoy. So all of that vanity stuff is all valid, but in the moment and the day that we live, there is also reason for joy, because God is still good to us, and God is giving us this life of labor and also the joys such as we are able to enjoy under his blessing here in this world. Okay? So it's both and, vanity of vanity, but then when we open up our minds and our hearts to the fact that God is blessing and doing all this, then there comes a sense of enjoyment, and in our thanksgiving, a true joy. Tomorrow I may lose my job, but today he has given me my job, and look at the fruits and the blessings he's given me through this job. And then if the job is taken away, we'll find other benefits that God has given to us in this world. And this is a nice, again, he's parted the sun and let the real sun in to illuminate our lives here in this vanity. So it is the key in that is that I also saw that was from the hand of God. And again, there we have God not isolated from his creation, but involved in his creation for the sake of his people. For God giveth to a man, God giveth to a man that is good in his sight, wisdom and knowledge and joy. God giveth to a man that is good in his sight, wisdom and knowledge and joy. And who is the man that he's talking about that is good in his sight? Is he good in his sight under the sun or under the sun? S-O-N. He who has faith in his son is the one that is good. For there is only one that is good, and that is God and God's son. So to those who are good in his sight, in other words, who depend on their righteousness from God, and in the Old Testament they were looking forward to the Messiah and the sacrifice that he would make, and in the New Testament, we look at the Son of God and the sacrifice that he made. Look at that, little darling. Is anything better than that? He giveth wisdom and knowledge and joy. And so the joy of the daily labor and the fruits of that labor is also of God. But to the sinner he giveth travail, to gather and to heap up, that he may give to him that is good before God. That also is vanity and vexation of spirit. So even when an evil person is allowed to gather and heap up goods, it is for the good of his church. It is for the good of his people that they are allowed to prosper. So in this, there's sort of a saying of Luther that I think it bottom lines things for me very well and helps to sort things out. Luther says that for those who are of God, those who are of faith, everything is of benefit and nothing is to his harm. And for those who have rejected God and are therefore his enemies, there is nothing that happens to them that is for their good, and it is all for their evil. So a rich unbeliever has their wealth not to their benefit, but to their detriment. Their wealth will hurt them as they misuse it under God. And the poverty of a believer is for his good, lest his heart be taken away from God by his riches, and he find all of his riches in God. Did I see a hand up? I didn't mean to. Yeah. The lottery. No. Well, again, he's not saying that the evil will give what they have unto the good, because that would be good, and the evil don't do good, they do evil. But what it means is that the evil dies, and through God's providence, he even uses the ill-gotten gains for the benefit of his church. Jesus says at one point something about making something good out of unrighteous mammon. Eventually, in God's grace, even that which is ill-gotten works out to be for his glory and the good of his people. Now, I don't want to go and say, give a bunch of examples of this. Football squares would be absolutely the worst. Or, you know, a Christian winning the lottery. A Christian should not play the lottery. That's coveting. That's wanting someone else's money without working for it. That's ill-gotten gains. I mean, some people are surprised when they say, hey, if I win the lottery, I'm going to give a bunch to the church. They're surprised when they hear the church won't accept it. Let's not get into that. Yeah, bingo. The lottery is an oppression of the poor. The poor who don't have enough say, I don't have enough anyway, I might as well gamble it away and see if I can get more.
In Jersey, back in the early 60s, when they instituted the state lottery, the biggest complaint against them was exactly that. And they got over the state. And who used to be in the cigarette shop while I'm looking at the magazine, buying the lottery? The guys that know I'm going to.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is an oppression on the poor, and we should not be a part of that. And, yeah. Okay. Anything else then from chapter 2 before we move on to 3? Now we're going to get to Bob Dylan, and I think it's the birds. For everything there is a season. Who said that?
Someone said turn. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. Who appoints those times? Yeah. There's nothing that the hand of God does not have a hand in. There is no calamity in the city, God says in Isaiah, that I have not wreaked. Did you raise your hand? Did I see a hand over here? We all have that problem, Judy. We all have. Okay. So what profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. This is really artistic. I mean, besides the fact that some of the pop artists have picked up on this beautiful section of poetry to make a really, I think, a really pretty song. And it's sort of a peacenik song, I think, trying to lay down the Vietnam War as they're singing that and that sort of thing. We're all Peter, Paul, and Mary fans as we're listening to that. Us older people are smiling, the young people are, what the heck is he talking? but there's sort of a wonderful diversity that he's spinning in here, that in this day-to-day routine of work, there come these hills and valleys of times that God appoints for us. I mean, there's the day-to-day drudgery, and then there's a time of birth where we can rejoice. And there's a time of death that comes into the community where we mourn. And there's a time for laughter, and there's a time for weeping. And there's a rich panoply of both the effects of sin and the blessings of God that impact and make for a very interesting life here upon the earth if we open up the windows and realize that there's more to what's happening under the sun, but there are God's dramatic interruptions to the cycles of life and in our families that God gives us. And these are the bottoms of the sorrow, the things that cause us the greatest grief and consternation, and the highs of God's blessing where we realize that he loves us so much. How could he have given me, a sinner, such great blessings as these things? And so there's a rich experience that the Christian has in his life because God interrupts the sameness of our life and days with all of these hills and valleys. And he loves each and every one of us. And as Jesus says, there's not a hair that falls off of our head that God has not numbered, that he has the hairs of our head numbered. And if we lose one, he knows about it. And so God is artistically working with these times and seasons in our lives. There's more than just the drudgery of day-to-day life. Anything else in that paragraph before we turn to the next paragraph? Verse 11, he hath made, God hath made everything beautiful in his time. So in the times he desires, he makes everything beautiful. Also, he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. Can you spot God at work? You can see the effects of God's work. Like I said, you've got the hills and the valleys, but you can't see the hand of God. And to me, this passage is, when it's talking about God as the creator, the maker, it also is very significant for our times. No man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. From the beginning to the end of what? Of everything. Of anything. You can't see God, or your parents couldn't even see God, as you were being formed by the egg and the sperm of your parents. That was done in the sanctuary and in the secret place. And God cannot, or no man can see when God claims our souls away from our bodies at the end, or when that will be, or to see whether the angels are bearing that soul up to home, or whether the devils are taking that soul down to hell. No man can see the work of God. And it also has to do with the beginnings and the end of the universe. Don't you dare believe the scientists and their myths about where the creation came from. Don't you dare believe those scientists and what they say about the creation when God, especially when it contradicts what God says that he did in creation in the first books of the Bible. And don't you dare believe that there's a meteor that we're going to spot and space cowboys are going to go up in a spaceship with a laser beam and save us from it. The world is going to end when God, and how God says it's going to end, by the fire that is going to unloose the elements that were bound together when he made that. It will all come apart and all creation will be unmade. And we will stand before God and have to give an account for our lives. Either giving an account under the blood of Christ or without it. Did I have, see a hand? Did you want to mention another movie, maybe? Okay. But again, I mean, these are fascinating. Aren't it? Doesn't our culture is just fascinated by these things, the idea of evolution and all the scientific myths that are given. And then they call the creation story the myth. Well, who's the mythster? Okay. So I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and do good in his life. And there again, don't look at the beginning and the end. Look at what God is doing in your life now. That's what we're to be seeing. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is a gift of God. Enjoy your life. Your labor makes you sweat and frustrated, but enjoy it. God has given it to you. When you bring home the paycheck and you're able to watch the Super Bowl this afternoon, that's a good sport, a nice clean sport. Pray that no one gets hurt and enjoy it. That also is given of God. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it, and God doeth it that men should fear before him. So look at the wonders of God and fear God, because you could lose him. You have the wherewithal in you called sin to lose him. Fear God. Fear being put away from him because of your indifference to his word and for your unthankfulness for all of the gifts that he's given you and for your complaining about all things under the sun. I'm not saying this is someone holier than that. I'm saying that about me. I mean, we have that within each and every one of us.
We see things and we think about them, but unfortunately, we sense
Well, the trouble with complaining is that it flows in the wrong directions. Complain to the Lord, not to other people. Isn't that a verse from I Know That My Redeemer Lives? He lives to hear my soul's complaint. And I'm always encouraged by that, because I complain a lot. But don't complain to your wife. Don't complain to your children. Don't complain to your fellow church members. Complain to the Lord. Complaints should go upstream. Unless I'm doing something wrong, then complain to me and tell me to fix it. And then I'll complain to him and ask him to fix it. Yes. No, when we pray to the Lord, we sort of leave it in His hands. And again, when we complain to the Lord, if we have a part in what's wrong, we ask the Lord to correct me or correct us. And that's sort of the foolishness about complaining to other people sometimes. We complain sometimes about things that we have control of, and we're really complaining about ourselves. And all this needs to be done in the confidence that there's one who can fix. You know, there's one who can fix and who will fix it. Then we complain with the idea that you can fix it and I can't. Fix me, you know, and fix me too. Fix me too. Verse 16, any others? Verse 16. Moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment, that wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. What's the place of judgment? The IRS. No, I'm serious. The courts, the government, the place of judgment. There's corruption in the government. The people that are placed by God to render judgments are corrupt. And they're not perfect. They do evil. Is there any perfect court system?
No. Not on earth.
Not on earth. Yeah, there is the high court. And the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. What's the place of righteousness? The church. Church and state. Is there unrighteousness in the church? Yeah. It's called me and you. So the place of righteousness, where you would expect holiness, there you find sin. I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. For there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. So what he's saying is that there will come a time where righteousness and wickedness will be sorted out. That's the promise. There may be injustice among sinful men, but there will be ultimate justice before God. God is going to sort it out. I said in mine heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, and that they may see that they themselves are beasts. For that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts, even one thing befalleth them, as the one dieth, so dieth the other. So what's it saying? We are like beasts. What does that mean? Yeah, we and the animals share mortality. We all die. And animals and we die because of sin. So he's saying, learn from the animals. You have been demoted to be like the animals. Did you ever notice in the Old Testament how when people are really evil, what is their curse? Remember Nebuchadnezzar? What happened to Nebuchadnezzar? He starts howling at the moon and his hair grows long and his fingernails grow like claws. He's the original wolf man. Aroo! You know, man in his sin becomes bestial, base like the animals, living by instinct and feelings instead of by mind and reason. And is it getting more and more like that? Hey, we're the monkeys.
I got that in my mind.
Singing it all right.
So we go on. Yea, they all have one breath, which means spirit. And you can go back to Genesis 2 and get this idea that when the animals are being raised out of the ground for Adam to name, it says all of the animals that have the breath of life in them, animals have a sort of animal spirit. And when their spirits depart, they expire like we do. Their animating principle, their spirit, is taken out of them. So that a man hath no preeminence above a beast for all his vanity. Verse 20, all go unto one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. Right? That's what happens. Under the sun, we see the same thing happening to animals dying as people. Now, this is a significant verse. Pay attention in Mark verse 21. Extremely crucial passage. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward, and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth? Are men and animals different? Yeah. The spirit of the animal returns to the earth from which it comes. It is not an immortal spirit. But man is made in the image of God with an immortal spirit. And so it says the spirit of the man goeth up. Why? It goes before God. It goes before the judgment of God. That's quite a verse. And it's sort of a pivotal verse in our, what would we say, our view of man and animals. There are a lot of times the kids ask, will my pet Fluffy be in heaven? You know, this is the verse. Fluffy's spirit goes down to the earth and the human spirit goes up before God. Well, yeah, and again, this is not to rob a child of the pleasure to say, hey, there might be even neater animals up in heaven. God will not deprive us of anything that we need to be happy up in heaven. But the first thing that we need to be happy in heaven is Jesus. And everything else that makes us happy is frosting on that cake. Don't worry. You might be riding ponies. Luther used to talk to his little kids about riding the ponies up in heaven. Might be the unicorns.
Then.
Well, it doesn't say who knows if. It's saying under the sun, how does a man know? How does he know that the spirit of the man goes up and the spirit of the animal goes down? Well, we can't know. It's revealed here. God knows, and God is revealing it here. The spirit of the man goes upward, and the spirit of the animal goes downward. It doesn't say who knows if. Well, again, you got to go by some translation, but it's given us some information here. And it's saying, who knows this information? We do when God tells us that. Yes?
Well, the way it's written, it seems to me what he's asking the question is, in the sense that who knows the spirit of man, who knows the spirit of the beast,
right?
One which goes to heaven, one which goes down. Which means it isn't so much who knows where the spirit goes, but who knows what that spirit is. We don't, but whatever it is, one goes up to God and one goes into us.
Yeah. Right. And again, Elaine, it's saying we're the same as the animals. Look at what happens to us and look at the animals. Don't you see that we're just like them? And then he shows the contrast. Now, does the Bible indicate, even in creation, that there's a contrast between us and the animals? It already reveals that contrast, and here it is using that contrast to say that the spirit of man in the image of God goes before God. Okay? The discussion just shows the significance of the passage.
Verse 22, wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion, which means that's what God has given him. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? No one, because his spirit has gone up. Yes?
Two quick things, just to punctuate. One is, you talked about the readings of Luther. I had the opportunity to read a really small book called The Christmas Sermons of Luther. And if somebody wants a nice Christmas introduction, I was very impressed by that book and the content. Just the wealth that's in those sermons of Luther about the cold Christmas season and stuff is very impressive.
Is that a CPH book?
I'm not sure where. My daughter bought it for me for Christmas, but I've seen it out over there.
Okay, so if you go on the CPH catalog online, there's a book of Luther on Christmas. Luther on Christmas.
Yeah.
Search that topic, you might find it. And I think it is a little book, which means
it's
very reasonable to read.
Very, very good read, but very powerful. The second thing, you talked about evolution. Tuesday night, there's an interesting lecture going on at the Creation Society down near Cincinnati. Bill Nye versus the creationists and this kind of stuff. So, if you're interested in the whole creation story over there, it should be a really good, like an hour and a half. Search for Bill Nye, February 4th,
I think you'll find it on the internet. So February 4th, Bill Nye and Ken Ham
are
debating creation evolution Tuesday night. Look it up on the internet, and hopefully there's a stream you can tie into. Tuesday evening. Bill Nye, the science guy. Ken Ham is one of the big kahunas in the Creation Society. God be with you.